Access number 29039, Mr. Alan Pollock, Real AT. Now, what's the point you're trying to develop here? I mean, is this the formation of the acrobatic?
Well, it was really, really just to say that many people don't remember that the beginning of the Red Arrows started with two or three sorties where we could have been court-martialed for what we were doing because it was so strictly forbidden. And obviously the official wisdom that the Nat could not do formation aerobatics was proved to be rubbish in within those two or three sorties. And the only point I was trying to make was the debt, in a way, to two people, Bob Lomax, this marvellous photographer that didn't mind being thrown around in the back seat of the Nat while we were experimenting with formation aerobatics, just the three of us. That was Lee Jones, Roger Hymans, both of whom had been on the Black Arrows Treble One Squadron, and myself as number three. And that date, as I say, was the 10th and 11th, 9/11, effectively, of 1963, which sticks in my mind. And he took a very good photograph of us vertical, and that literally was the beginning of the Red Arrows, that photograph of them completely vertical as we were going through.
It's a very impressive photograph. It's amazing. You wouldn't know it was vertical and except for the sky.
Yeah.
So what was the next stage in the development of the aerobatics team for Nat formation?
Virtually everything went on the back burner after that, apart from the fact that when that photo was developed the following morning, because they did it quite rapidly, and Lee asked me to, he said, "You know the Wing Commander flying best, and Roger Hymans also." I was kind of voted in to go and chat up the Wing Commander Edwards, and Bill Edwards is the second person I'd like to, you know, who was at the Wing Commander flying then. He'd got enough problems there running the flying training school without the extra hassle developing an aerobatic team, but he had the vision to see, partly because at this stage, at the end of 1963, even though we were still having serviceability problems, we were having quite a few aircraft were coming in, and there were more instructors on stream there. And because, again, he'd been instructing down at Central Flying School and was a very progressively minded individual, I just like to say and pay tribute to him, because often things happen only because of individuals having a positive frame of mind. And
so
he could see the advantage. I actually left that photo on his desk, because he was out of the office for, I think, a couple of hours, and it was literally like lighting a blue touch paper, because we thought, what's going to happen? Because it was such a forbidden thing then. But fortunately, he could see the advantages for it, and
now what are
very
the
quickly.
What are
well,
the
of having a aerobatic team at the same time being developed, and there were other factors at play already by then, because the Lightning teams were going to be to take over from the Hunter were already proving to be a very expensive diversion, in a way, from their main role. And the idea of having trainers and advanced trainers, and the Nat looked extremely good in formation, you know, because of its swept wings. And even though it did have a slight problem of small size, because by then I was already, partly because of the amount of flying I'd done, but we had an aerobatic competition, and I won the aerobatic competition for becoming the command display pilot for the following year.
Now, what was the aerobatics competition?
Well, it was just between the instructors that wanted to do it. I think there were probably five or six of us, I don't know, but several of them had already won their Clarkson Trophy at Little Rissington when they'd come through the course on the Jet Provost and that, because it was interesting to see how many of them had been involved with the Clarkson, and in a way that proved the value of doing that. And partly, I suppose, also since I'd had that disqualification at and I was always interested in the low-level aerobatics, and I took over the second year from Tony Doyle.
So
Tony Doyle, if I could just mention, he actually took that photograph that we're talking about.
Okay. So what did you actually do to win the competition? I mean, did you have to set out a program, or was it just done on general flying, you know, that they'd seen you do? I mean, was there an actual competition?
Yeah, I think to start with, it was down to a height above the airfield, and it's a difficult thing to explain, but to start with, for safety reasons, you have to do your aerobatics with a slightly higher safety height to encourage people that you're safe enough to get down to lower levels. And it is more difficult to do those higher aerobatics in a strange way than it is when you get down and get used to doing everything at extremely low level. And it was just really, you had a kind of 7 minute window roughly. That was sort of later. 7 minutes was about an ideal time to do a singleton aerobatic displays in the NAT.
And would you have to all do the same?
No, you'd have to do certain maneuvers and then voluntary maneuvers, and tie them all together. And the NAT was extremely good on that, and it had the high rate of roll, and it was just a question of, you know, that you could do very good low-level derry turns and a variety of things in it, and you could finish and disappear out of sight quite well in your final manoeuvres of going upwards at the end. There were a whole variety of things you could do in the NAT, and the other interesting thing was we started... I twigged quite early that when the visibility wasn't very good, you could switch your landing light on, and that was quite an attractive thing below the clouds.
Now, this meant in your second year, what were you, the display pilot?
Well, just...
You won this competition. What did that mean?
Well, it just meant that you had the responsibility for going away and representing the command and the aircraft as well, as much as anything. And it was still quite new then for aerobatic displays away. But getting back to where we started about the flight commander, because that was an added role, and at weekends you went away for the formation the singleton aerobatic display, and it did mean. Particularly in that year when I was effectively doing, I think, as I said, 400 hours flying, that plus the flight commander's role, where we were planning to start with at Christmas 1963, the beginnings of the squadron, when there was very little in those days, because it was still early days for the ground display charts, that we virtually got no support or budget, even though a big new operations block was being developed for the support from command or group. I thought was pretty limited.
Support for what? For the flight?
For actually developing on the ground useful instructional posters that I ended up literally doing them myself, you know, working long hours over Christmas 1963, which led in a way to the incident on New Year's Day, where we were setting up the new squadron, because I can remember literally doing loads of different charts so that the new people on the squadron, which included the instructors by then, the less experienced instructors coming in to help start the new squadron, as well as the students. They really did need a whole variety of very clear diagrams, which I'd only wished could have been better, and I just did them in very large sort of poster type format of the various types of arrival and descent procedures and the TACAN approach, the ILS approach, and all the master things like that, because coupled with the difficulties or the intrinsic complexity of the aircraft, there was a lot for youngsters to understand, and they got limited amount of time to do it. So obviously their time on the ground, when they could just go and look at posters and diagrams, was useful. And the point of really what I'm saying is, over that Christmas, I was probably pretty clapped by the time we actually started the squadron on January the 1st, and Dennis and myself.
And this was number two squadron?
Effectively, it was a second squadron, but it was actually number one squadron, the way things worked out, because the intensive flying trial had taken over number two squadron that was a vampire, and then we were starting up a new number one squadron, the way things worked, from scratch. And very quickly, we were over into the new operations
is this
block.
The same number one squadrons that have been at Cranwell, aren't
no,
they?
No. Every FTS had a normally would have a number one squadron, a number two squadron,
right,
a number three squadron.
Sorry,
okay?
I didn't understand.
And that was
right.
Split into flights as well. And to start with, we were really starting with a big flight, effectively, on number one squadron. And it was really restarting from scratch, number one squadron. And it was those lack of facilities that really I'm saying, where it was almost impossible, apart from minor local purchases, because of the Air Force system. And there they were spending multi-million pounds in nowadays on the bricks and mortar for this massive new operations block. And yet the things that we knew were necessary sort of a couple of months or 6 weeks before, it was virtually impossible to get any budget or support to do that. And the fact that we had to do it by ourselves, and really in terms of the glorified flight safety that was theoretically so important there, with the actual pressures of meeting and organising the switch from the ground school, introduction for the guys coming straight into the I'm talking about the students now, plus the fact that some of the instructors had not got that amount of time on. They'd come through the course, two or three of them, and done not that much extra flying. So I'm not really whinging. I'm just stating as a matter of fact that we, you know, two of us were working our jacksies off that Christmas, and we decided, rightly or wrongly, partly because we were tired and partly because it was a new squadron to celebrate, and we just got airborne, the three of us, and took the parachutes out of the back. We sort of chatted up the technicians almost as an experiment, and filled the container at the back with toilet rolls, having in theory they were to be used for the brake chute. But that particular morning was brilliant weather, and there was no real danger about it, because with the long runway, and obviously it was an unorthodox thing to do, but we just did a raid down on Central Flying School, like Bodenplatte, the New Year's Day raid of 1945, where the Germans, and it was really just to say we'd arrived and put the new squadron on the mat, and then I went across to.
You actually jettisoned the toilet roll.
Yes, over. Well, we had three aircraft, and then went up to Shinfield Park, which was the headquarters of Flying Training Command, and we were a bit short then, and not quite certain exactly where it was. It sounds a bit inefficient, and maybe it was, because the only briefing I'd had was literally at 12:30 at night, or 12:30 that morning, at the New Year's function, the sort of New Year's ball and time in the mess from somebody that said, you will recognise the Shinfield Park, which was amongst the in outskirts of Reading, by green roofs. And there was no problem on the raid at Little Rissington, where we dropped at Little Rissington, but by the time we'd got across at low level, the weather had got very bad around Reading, and just as we were roughly in the right area, these copper roofs came up, but in fact they were about a mile and a half short of where we were, which in a way was ideal, but we were running out of fuel anyway, and we had to punch up to get clear of the airway on the way back because of the weather and the visibility, and we were running out literally of fuel and time then, and dropped them down, and it was Arbourfield in the rain. The visibility was very poor then, but by the time we got back to base and landed, there was no problem about the brake chutes because the weather was so good, and the experiment worked as far as because the point I hadn't made was the Nat had got absolutely no armament, so this is the only armament you could put in was to take the brake chutes out. But literally by 9:30 that morning, I'd had my flight taken away from me, and intriguingly, it was given to Dennis quite correctly to take the flight over for 2 days. But he had been on the raid too, because he'd been with me, so it was really Mickey.
So Mickey Mouse. The authorities reacted very badly to it.
Well, yes, but maybe they should have done that. But two days later, I was forgiven again and given back the flight. And what was quite interesting was the next month too. I was given the commander in chief, which is Gus Walker, to fly in a Nat, and he only had one arm. And what was splendid was the way he did manage to fly the aircraft remarkably well, because he'd been in bomber command during the war as well, and very press on individual. And it was a strange situation to have an air chief marshal there that I think he insisted on being the captain of the aircraft as well, which I think was a slightly strange thing to do. But and I forget how we sorted that out, but I'm pretty certain that he put himself in as the captain of the aircraft, yet I obviously had total responsibility for him. And I can remember his insisting on doing the final landing, and our having a small sort of 15-second discussion about that it might not be the right thing. But to rightly or wrongly, I conceded and let him have a go at it, and was sort of following him through quite well. But he did manage to burst one tyre. But again, he was very happy when I took him out of the aircraft and showed him the splayed undercarriage and why and how I'd briefed him that he had to keep his ailerons with getting the extra weight on the aircraft and that. And once he saw that splayed undercarriage underneath physically, and I'd shown him as we got out of the aircraft, he went back, pleased as punch, to flying training command, because he then knew that the tyre wear on the Nats, why they were using more tyres than normal, because obviously it was, again, that students flying, and that he was sort of very pleased for that experience. And also, I think I showed him the rate of roll that the Nat had when it was supersonic, because a lot of people in the Hunters never rolled the aircraft when it was supersonic, but the Nat, you could roll supersonic, and it was a very good thing to do for the youngsters too, in terms of confidence.
What about the development of the yellow?
The yellow jacks.
Is that the next thing?
Yeah, the yellow jacks. No, you're right. That was happening at about that time. Early April, we had fly-offs, and I think Roger Hymans and myself, I had three trips with Lee Jones again leading, and I was offered the number three slot. For the Nat team, But because I was already doing the low-level aerobatics and already was responsible for the second NAT squadron, which was actually number one squadron, slightly confusingly, by that time we'd actually got a squadron commander with us, because up to then there was only Timber Woods, who I like very much as a bloke, who was really, in a way, a surrogate squadron commander, not really a squadron commander, because he was involved in the standards side of things, and he'd also been on my course at Rissington when he'd done his second instructional course there. But at that time, we were taking volunteers from the other instructors on the FTS who would want to be a team. Initially, it would look as though it was going to be a five. And we had fly-offs with them, and it was a combination of people that wanted to do it and people that could do it. And that developed quite rapidly into what became the Yellow Jacks.
Now, were you in it or not?
No.
You weren't, yeah.
Although I did occasionally fly the yellow aircraft as a singleton, because I was doing the singleton display.
And did the team develop well?
Yes, I think in many ways Lee put them on the map extremely well that year, and that led to the Red Arrows being formed in 1965. Yes, but that was not all. All I would like to say was that Yellow Jacks were formed at Valley, and that was in effect the necessary precursor, because of the facilities they had up at Valley and the encouragement and the sort of context and environmental support they had up there for it all, which allowed the later, I would say, colonization, I don't think that's too strong a word, of the team, which became the Red Arrows down at Little Rissington, and effectively they were out at Kemble, any rate. They were sort of remoted out at Kemble. But without that early stage, we wouldn't have had the Red Arrows. And again, you know, full marks to Lee Jones for sort of running with it then. And those on the Yellow Jack team, because they became the embryo of the Red Arrows. But the Red Arrows were formed down at Central Flying School, at Kemble.
And was that the end of the Yellow Jack?
And Fairford. Yes, they'd only did the 1 year. And then, interestingly, at the end of the first year of the Red Arrows, with Lee flying it, it was almost the very last year of the Red Arrows, and people forget that, because it was virtually disbanded. And then various events occurred. And part of the reason it was a slightly negative element was that Lee was asked, almost insisted on, and again, it was to do a show at over Shinfield Park as their last one of the season. And that was after Farnborough. They'd done well at Farnborough, and really shown up that the swept wing aircraft were far more popular with the public, and it's a far more dramatic display than the Red Pelicans had, who were with them for a very short part of their display, so people could compare them in a way. And I think the Air Force was rather naughty in a way, because I don't think Lee was never given an Air Force Cross for his work, and considering how important it was later, I thought that was rather churlish of them, because his role, you could say that in some ways he might have had too light a rein on some of the more social aspect that was developed of the Red Arrows later in a more formal way. But he did put the team on the map, and they won the trophy that year too, the Britannia Trophy, which was not given lightly. But the Red Arrows, after this command thing that was going to be their last show, partly to do with Shinfield Park and the number of complaints they had, because I think there were literally 1,000 people said letters in not being too happy about what they were doing over the built-up area. But Lee had been tasked with that, and it's very easy after the event to see what goes wrong with things. And I think it's a great shame, you know, that Lee Jones, his role is not more acknowledged. And the following year, of course, Ray Hanna took over, and Ray was in that first year's team.
Now, one thing we still never really covered, we discussed what you did as flight commander to sort of get the charts and everything, but what was your role as flight commander, you know, besides doing the charts?
Well, really, you had to make certain that, and it was a combination of encouraging and developing the syllabus, which already by then was fairly well defined. And the progress of all the students that you had, and also your instructors. You were really responsible for the whole caboosh of the flying standards and approach and development of the flying training, advanced flying training syllabus. And I might have mentioned that we developed an extremely good exercise for the students on the NAT, which was 32 minutes flying around Ireland at low level on what was a development of or a modification to the low-level bomber command route. And we would just take off normally on the sort of southwesterly southeasterly runway from Valley and do a port climb out up to 30,000 feet on a northwesterly heading and let down into Northern Ireland, just close to Newcastle there, letting down to the sea and coasting in, which was a very interesting thing for the youngsters at that stage to do. And they could operate the TACAN. They would know roughly where they were at the top of the climb, and then they do what we called in the Air Force a high low high, so that they'd go up to high level and they'd let down to below the cloud, and then they'd coast in. And it was a interesting thing for them to do then, and flew all round Northern Ireland, but on the west side, so to speak, of Loch Ness, the big lake there, because to the north, to the east of that was Belfast and Aldergrove and what have you. And they would just fly all around Northern Ireland and come back on a slightly parallel but different route. But we'd coast in at Newcastle and past Armagh, and sometimes when the weather was bad there, you could actually just see Armagh Cathedral as a pinpoint when you passed it. And then when they came out at low level 32 minutes later from to the coast, this was all at 360 knots, 6 miles a minute. And then we'd punch up to high level again to go back over the Irish Sea into Valley for one of various types of descent, but probably again through Point Alpha. And doing a modified TACAN or TACAN approach. The various other elements were very much like what they'd done earlier, but on the jet provost aircraft, you know, the circuit work was very important in the NAT, and also the problem was the emergencies, because to some extent the emergencies were slightly too complicated, ideally for a trainer, and that aspect is much better in the Hawk. And the Hawk has been much more reliable, and it's been much cheaper. But the NAT was an extremely good aircraft in terms of the fact that they had to get up to speed and they had to react quickly, and it was a lovely aircraft to fly.